This episode of Food for Thought is brought to you by the listeners of this podcast. That means you. If you value this podcast, you can head over to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau and become a patron today. Thank you, as always, to benefactors David Cabrera and Alexander Gray, Angels Brooke Boussard, Michal Stone, Gina Stryler, and Carrie Parker. Thank you to my heroes, Simon Small, Angelica Lofton, Jennifer Stadtmiller, Jennifer Watkins, Geraldine Hilmar, PJ Schuster, Denise Hoskins, Ranjini Mohan, Tina Strassheim, and Liz D. Thanks to everyone who supports this podcast. Thanks to everyone who listens to the podcast and everyone who leaves ratings and reviews. Welcome to Food for Thought. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I'm your host. My work is dedicated to empowering people to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. Today's topic is feasting and festivities during the 12 days of Christmas. Welcome, everyone, and hello. I hope you're doing fabulously well. We are steeped in the holiday season right now, and you can consider this episode part two of a two-part series on food and fasting, or I should say feasting and fasting, or I should really say fasting and feasting, because one does follow the other. Fasting comes first, feasting comes next, and we're talking about fasting and feasting during the holiday season in particular. Part one was called Forbidden Meat, Fasting and Abstinence During Advent, and today we're going to talk about not fasting, but feasting during Christmas. So you've got Advent fasting and Christmas feasting. Christmas, and especially the 12 days of Christmas, for centuries was all about the feasting and the festivities and the revelry of the 12 days of Christmas. And that's what we're going to talk about today. If you listen to the episode on Advent fasting, you will know that that period, the period before Christmas, the period leading up to Christmas in the Christian liturgical calendar was called Advent. And it was a pretty pivotal time of year in Christianity, the birth of baby Jesus. Whereas Easter in Christianity and its preceding period of Lent is really the holier of the two holidays and the hook upon which Christianity does hang its hat. Advent before Christmas, Advent was the period before Christmas, was also a time of solemnity and self-reflection and penitence and contrition. But it was also, and more so than with Lent, about the joyous anticipation of Christmas, of the birth. And once Christmas comes, it is all about celebration and merriment and feasting and revelry and even the turning upside down of some societal norms, as we'll see in Twelfth Night, which of course is the 12th day of Christmas, 12th night, also known as the Epiphany. And we'll see that in the form of the Lord of Misrule, which may be a precursor to Father Christmas. And we'll get there. We will get there. We'll get to the revelry. We'll get to the feasting. We'll get to the festivities. But one of the things that has struck me in the last few years, as I continue to forge my own meaning out of this time of year, out of my life, is that having a period of contemplation and solemnity and abstinence before a period of feasting makes the feasting and the merriment a lot more special, a lot more justified. Right? So we live in a time and we live in a place, I'll speak for myself, we live in a situation, our lives are such, my life, my husband's life are such that we are privileged to have abundance pretty much every single day. So is there really a huge differentiation between a meal I can get on any given Thursday or a meal I can make on any given Thursday and a meal I can make for Christmas? Not really. And I think that's probably the case for many of us. And so as part of my search for meaning and my intention to live a meaningful life. It's just something I think about, and it's something I started putting in place in my own life throughout the year, but also during this time of the year when we are celebrating. And what is it that we're celebrating? It's different for different people. But I'm really mindful of, if I am going to have a celebration, and I am, and I do, and I will, what does the period before that celebration look like? And we're going to talk about the feasting. We're going to talk about, say, for instance, in Tudor times, 500 years ago, when it was a situation where the majority of the people, your average person, not of the nobility, was poor and lived in a rural place and most likely worked the land, most likely were working in agriculture in some form or another. They were poor and they were really beholden to the lord of the manor. They were beholden to the person whose estate they were working, right? And so by the time Christmas came around, it was, they looked forward to it because Christmas, not only because it was a part of people's religious lives as well, but it was also a time to not work for 12 days. It was a time to finally feast after having fasted. So there was this real counter balance between, you know, deprivation and abundance, between fasting and feasting. And so you could see the dichotomy, whereas I think the dichotomy is a little less clear today. And so is there something to take from that? Is there something I can take from that past, from that history, and make meaning of it and create my own dichotomy? Maybe not as drastic as, you know, kind of living in poverty for 30 days or 40 days before Christmas. But what would it look like to actually enable the abundance to be more meaningful than as if I were just, or as when I am just experiencing abundance throughout the year, including the time leading up to more abundance? So that's what I've been thinking of. I talked in the Advent fasting episode about Lent, how I grew up giving things up for this period before Easter. I grew up Catholic, and I grew up, you know, you give something up for Lent, and Lent again is the 40 days before Easter. And I haven't practiced that habit specifically for Lent in the last several years, but I've been having fun with the idea of giving things up during Advent, if only to put into practice some of this self-discipline I'm talking about and to appreciate the Christmas feast just a little bit more. And so last year, I approached David and started talking about what we might give up in anticipation for the Christmas feast we were hosting on December 24th, and I'm going to talk about that momentarily. And when I say what might we give up, whenever I talk about how we decided to do something like give something up for Advent, or we decided to host a party, or we decided to host Christmas Eve, just know it's never David coming to me saying, could we give something up for Advent, or could we host Christmas Eve? He just goes along with it because he's the most amazing husband and knows it makes me happy. And he's always, you know, he's always game for whatever I come up with, because, or I should say, he's usually game for what I come up with, because they're usually pretty good ideas. So when I go to him with something like, hey, you know, I've been thinking about this and making Christmas more meaningful, making our lives more meaningful, and experiencing more gratitude and practicing some kind of deprivation in order to appreciate the abundance more, David's on board. He gets it. And so I went to him and said, what do you think? What do you think about giving something up for Advent? So we did. Now, we gave up, and I'm doing it again this year, some things, and I'll tell you what they are, for Advent. Now, in the Advent episode, I talked about how Advent, you know, in most Orthodox religions would be 40 days before Christmas. In Christianity, before Easter, Lent is still 40 days. Advent really tends to be 40 days in the Orthodox calendar. I'm going by a more contemporary, as well as secular calendar, of 30 days of Lent. Most people, if they are practicing Advent in any way these days, and if they're not Orthodox, it would usually be 4 Sundays prior to Christmas. It wouldn't be 40 days. So we're talking 30 days. I said, let's give something up for 30 days before Christmas so that when Christmas comes along, that's going to feel really special. And so last year I gave up, and I think David did the same thing. I gave up sugar, bread, and nuts. Now, do I eat sugar, bread, and nuts every single day of my life? No. But still, it's especially around Christmas time, the holidays, I'm teaching cooking classes. And in fact, I did teach a cooking class last year. It was a baking class and a food holiday gifts class. Like, you know, I was cooking with sugar, I was baking with sugar and bread and probably nuts. So I actually was doing that and not consuming it. So that's even more disciplined. But look, I didn't give up wine for 30 days. I didn't give up tea for 30 days. But I did give up things that I eat, you know, fairly regularly, enough that it was like, ooh, bread, gosh, okay, I'm not going to have any bread with that soup or what have you. So it was, and especially in the wintertime when that is a real, you know, staple in our home, especially because soups are a staple in our home. So I gave up sugar, bread, and nuts prior to Christmas. And when our Christmas Eve celebration came along, it was really special. So I think there's something really meaningful, and at least for me, something I can take from that idea of abstinence, of practicing sacrifice. Sacrifice sounds like such a loaded word. I don't know, maybe deprivation is a word that I want to use. Maybe that's better. I don't know, self-discipline, right? Maybe that's what it is. Even the word suffering, I want to use it. That feels loaded too, but there is something to it. There is something about making ourselves be a little more uncomfortable in order to experience whatever it is we're trying to experience, right? And this idea, of course, I talked about it, about, you know, related to Advent, of sacrifice or abstinence and suffering, self-denial. This is not unique to Christianity at all. I have talked a number of times about the philosophies that guide my own life, compassion being the main philosophy, if you will, that guides my life. But you've heard me talk about Stoicism and Taoism. And if you are a supporter, by the way, getting bonus materials, you will be receiving my suggested reading list for both Taoism and Stoicism if you'd like to explore that more. So just make sure you're checking your Patreon account. One of the principles in Stoicism is discipline and temperance as a way to, quite literally, temper desire in order to appreciate what you have. Because everything we have, in reality, is always just a step away from being taken away from us, right? And so in Stoicism, being aware of this and practicing what that means is what, you know, one example would be called memento mori. Memento mori means remember you will die. In other words, remember that you will die so that you will live more fully and more meaningfully. And we'll talk about that in a moment. In Taoism, similarly, and of course in Buddhism as well, the concept of non-desire is tantamount to both Taoism and Buddhism. Now, I don't profess in any way to be a practitioner of Buddhism. I tend more toward Taoism, but I do incorporate aspects of Buddhism into my daily practice, including something I look forward to sharing with you that I hope might be inspiring for you as well. So we've got Taoism, Stoicism, Buddhism. I mean, and of course, I talked about Christianity in the sense of practicing abstinence, practicing self-denial, practicing the idea of really unattachment, not being attached, non-attachment, I should say, because desire is one of the sources of suffering. And so you see that in so many different religions and so many different secular philosophies. In Taoism, it is all about non-desire, not being attached. And in Buddhism, the main tenet is that desire is the cause of suffering. Attachment is the cause of suffering. So here are a few quotes from the Tao Te Ching. colors blind the eye, sounds deafen the ear, flavors numb the taste, thoughts weaken the mind, desires wither the heart. Another one, chapter 37, is the Tao never does anything, yet through it all things are done. If powerful men and women could center themselves in it, the whole world would be transformed by itself in its natural rhythms. People would be content with their simple everyday lives in harmony and free of desire. When there is no desire, all things are at peace. From 52, chapter 52, if you close your mind in judgments and traffic with desires, your heart will be troubled. If you keep your mind from judging and aren't led by the senses, your heart will find peace. Even hope in the Tao, in Taoism, is a form of desire. You might remember me quoting this line in the past from chapter 13. It starts with, success is as dangerous as failure, hope is as hollow as fear, and then it goes on. What does it mean that hope is as hollow as fear? Hope and fear are both phantoms that arise from thinking of the self. When we don't see the self as self, what do we have to fear? So that idea of separateness and desire as a cause of suffering. So that is pretty prevalent throughout the Tao. In Buddhism, which of course states explicitly that desire is the cause of suffering, that attachment is the cause of suffering. And by desire, Buddhists would refer to craving pleasure, craving material goods, craving immortality, right? All of which are wants and desires that can never really be fully satisfied. And so if you're persuaded by that, if you, listening, are persuaded by that, that suffering comes from desire, an attachment to something that then when we don't get, we suffer, right? We feel bad about, right? So that desire for pleasure, the desire for material things, the desire for stature, the desire for power, the desire for control, the desire for perfection, the desire for immutability, that we want everything to stay the same all the time, the desire for immortality, that we never want things to end or die. All these things we humans crave, I am convinced by that, that our suffering comes from desire. And our attachment to it, to these things. And the suffering comes from not being able to attain these things, at least for very long. Different religions or philosophies have ways to practice than how to reconcile that, right? And so that's kind of what we're talking about, how all these different philosophies and religions that would have you practice and use tools to lessen your suffering to lessen your suffering, you want to lessen your desires and your reaching for things, right? And so that's where practicing temperance comes in. That's where discipline comes in. That's where unattachment comes in. It's where non-desire comes in. It's where abstinence comes in and fasting, right? And so those are ways to basically alleviate that suffering, because if we're not attached to something, if we're not desiring something, then we're less inclined to miss it. We're less inclined to suffer. And so we can see that in all these different religions and philosophies. We see it in Advent. We see it in Lent, right before these holidays. I'm using Christianity as an example here. And for me, I seek out these tools in Stoicism and Taoism, these tools being, how do I live with less suffering, with less anxiety, with less angst? How do I do that? And Stoicism and Taoism happens to have the tools that speak to me. Everybody, different tools will speak to different people. The tools in Stoicism and Taoism speak to me, and elements of Buddhism as well. And there's a tool in Buddhism that I use, and that's the concept of the five remembrances. And I'd like to share these with you right now. The five remembrances are intended to be memorized. They're intended, I'm memorizing the Tao Te Ching, still doing it. There's 81 chapters, and I'm a third of the way there. I've slowed down a bit, but that's my intention. But these kinds of remembrances, in this case, the five remembrances, they're things to say every day. They're things we can memorize. They're things that are meant to be recited. They are part of, these five remembrances are part of what I say when I wake up in the morning. They're part of what I say when I go to bed at night. They are things that I say in my head throughout the day. So they are tools that I use quite frequently. And they have become internalized for me. But the only way they are becoming internalized for me is because they're part of my practice. And they have become a touchstone. And they are, for me, a constant reminder that can help reduce that suffering. And they remind me, which they're meant to do, they remind me of my limitations and my humanness. And they enabled me to find joy in this thing called life. Ironically, because like Memento Mori, you might think they sound kind of bleak, but if you really understand the flip side of them, or if you understand them, you understand the flip side is actually where there's the joy and there's peace. So here are the five remembrances. And I promise we're going to get to the revelry and we're going to get to the feasting, but I really can't talk about feasting and revelry until I first talk about kind of the opposite of that, which is the contemplation and the deprivation and the abstinence. So the five remembrances. Number one, I am of the nature to grow old. Number two, I am of the nature to have ill health. Number three, I am of the nature to die. Number four, all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change or disappear. There is no way to escape being separated from the things and the people and the animals I love. And number five is my actions are my only true belongings. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. And I take that one to be a lot about control, and the only thing I can control are my actions. No one else's. So there it is, in that perfect, concise, and powerful way. Just like Memento Mori, remember you will die. I am of the nature to grow old. I am the nature to get sick. I am of the nature to die. And everything I love and everyone I love is of the nature to change. That change is the only constant. All we have right now, right here, is all we have. And for that, we can be grateful. That we will die and grow old and get sick. From that, we cannot hide. About that fact that we will die and grow old and get sick, we cannot pretend otherwise. As it relates to ourselves and as it relates to the people we do love or the animals we love or the things we're attached to, and you can say it in the second person, and I think this can be really helpful for us because we don't want to lose the people, the animals. We don't want to lose them. We don't want things to change. And yet you are of the nature to grow old. You are of the nature to die. You are of the nature to get ill. You are going to suffer separation and loss. And so that's what it means to be in the here and now, is to be aware of those facts. And in doing so, in letting go of attachment to wanting to hold on to the people we love and to the animals we love, and we want to hold on to our lives, and we don't want to die, and we don't want to get sick, and we don't want to get old. If that's our orientation, we're going to be pretty disappointed all the time. So if our orientation is, no, I am of the nature to grow old, to get sick, to die, to lose everything around me, then in letting go and knowing what I can and cannot control, we're better able to appreciate even more what we have right here and now. And so that's why I find that so comforting in the Taoism, in the attachment, the desire, in the Buddhism, in these remembrances of who I am and what I'm made of. And in Stoicism, the same idea, the Memento Mori, and the discipline and temperance that are required to practice that, right? Because the Stoics knew what it looked like for, you know, desire. They knew that desire made us miserable. Epictetus wrote in the Enchiridion, he wrote, "He is a wise man who does not grieve for things which he has not, but rejoices for those which he has. Okay, pretty trite, it sounds like, because we all know that, you know, be grateful for what we have. But they didn't just say that in this kind of, you know, new age way. They said it, but they actually practiced it. And in practicing that, what they did was, in some cases, go to pretty high extremes. They, in order to make themselves appreciate what they had, they would deliberately, like, not only contemplate losing everything they loved. Marcus Aurelius talks in his meditations, he writes in his meditations that when he goes to bed every night and he says goodnight to his children. Now, this was a man who lost many of his children. And so it wasn't crazy that he, when he would say goodnight to his remaining children, would kiss them and say to himself, "You may be dead tomorrow. You may not be here tomorrow." And that might sound morbid, but it's the opposite. It means that I am going to appreciate you so much more, knowing that you are right here, right now, and you are so precious, because tomorrow you might not be here. That is the reality for all of us. And that's what Marcus Aurelius practiced. That's what the Stoics practiced. And so, like the Buddhist reminder above, they would think about death a lot, a lot. And they would deprive themselves of pleasures to force themselves to stop taking things for granted. That's part of the Stoic practice. Seneca wrote in Moral Letters 18, "Here's a lesson to test your mind's mettle. Take part of a week in which you have only the most meager and cheap food, dress in shabby clothes, and ask yourself if this is really the worst that you feared." So the idea of kind of purposefully denying yourself the things that you normally take for granted is part of Stoicism. It's part of what we're seeing in Lent at Christianity and Advent in especially old Christianity. And it's part of what we see in this concept of self-denial. And, you know, it works. It's really powerful. And it's something we can practice all the time, not just at Christmas time, not just during Advent, right? You love coffee, you love tea. Well, just don't have it for 3 days. You know, skip having your morning coffee for 3 days and see how you feel the next time you have that cup of coffee, right? It's going to feel a lot different than when you have even coffee every single day. When you deprive yourself of something, you savor it even more when you do get to enjoy it, right? So that's the concept. That is the concept of denying ourselves something so that we can appreciate it even more. Deprivation and then revelry. And so that's one way to just really find appreciation and find gratitude and find meaning in our lives, and especially during the holidays. So that's the deprivation I'm talking about. It's what makes us savor things even more. These words are almost not, they're not ringing for me, because I know they can feel really heavy to say self-deprivation and denial and abstinence and fasting and sacrifice and all of that sounds so heavy. Suffering, right? And I'm not talking about any of this as a road to martyrdom, which I think in some cases we might have an association. We might have that association. I know I certainly did for a very long time, having grown up Catholic and having heard of so many saints who would starve themselves until they quite literally died. And so, and I, you know, I shared a story about my father and a way that he, you know, struck a bargain and denied something of himself as penance. And that doesn't speak to me, especially, well, you'll have to go listen to see what I was talking about. But there can be in some of our minds an association between deprivation and martyrdom. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the deprivation so that we can savor, so that we can revel in what we have. And that leads us to the 12 days of Christmas, because that is what the 12 days of Christmas were, is, was all about, right? Following the scarcity of Advent, And this is historic because this is historical. This is not something you see very often today, but historically, following the scarcity of Advent was the feasting of Christmas, and not just for one night, not just for two nights. It wasn't just Christmas Day. It wasn't just Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. It was for 12 days. So the idea was that you would be fasting for 40 days and not fasting as in completely depriving yourself of food. Not really. If you were a lay person, you were most likely abstaining from certain foods, most likely meat and or dairy and or eggs. So animal products mostly. And then on Christmas Day, you would begin 12 decadent days of feasting and singing and carousing and not working, by the way, because you'd be working so hard. And again, so often you'd be working in the fields and you'd be working very physically, but you would not be working for the 12 days of Christmas. You would be carousing and feasting, and it would culminate in 12th night or Epiphany. Now, 12th night, you could just go read Shakespeare's 12th night to understand what that's all about. 12th night is fun, and we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about that and kind of what that meant. But that's what the 12 days of Christmas is. It's not 12 days leading up to Christmas. I think when I was young and I first heard the song, the 12 days of Christmas, I think, oh, it was 12 days in Christmas, 12 days leading up to Christmas. Because even when I was growing up, Advent was not a thing, and the 12 days of Christmas starting on the 25th and going to January 6th was not a thing in my upbringing. Some of you who may have been raised, especially in different like Eastern or Orthodox or Coptic churches, may have experienced that. But for me, it was all about Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, not the 12 days starting on December 25th and ending on January 6th on the Epiphany. And the Epiphany, by the way, is when the kings arrived, the three kings. So last year, after having given up those things, I was anticipating and was planning for hosting Christmas Eve because we were home for Christmas. Our Joyful Vegan Botswana trip was moved for the third time because of coronavirus. So it was a trip that was originally supposed to take place in 2020. COVID made us move it to 2021. And then COVID again made us move it into 2022. And so here we are. In fact, as you're listening to this episode, I am most likely in Botswana. As I'm recording it, I'm leaving for Rwanda just in a couple days. So I will be there. But because we were here last year for Christmas, I was talking to a friend and I said, I really want to make this special. I don't know, I always want to make it special, but I really wanted to make it even more special. And I knew I was going to be giving up the sugar and the nuts and the bread for 30 days. And I started talking to friends about hosting Christmas Eve in a really fun way. And I wanted to do it in this kind of old-fashioned way, filled with revelry and games and music and food and drink and fun. Now, that's not very different than most of our parties. I will say that we do have revelry and games and music and food and drink and fun. And I was just doing it in a more conscious way. And I decided to do it in a way that was very, an homage to a time period and a place when this really would have been the case. And so I decided to make it a Tudor style Christmas because the Tudor Christmas season was all about feasting and eating and drinking and games and decadence and partying for 12 days. So when I decided to do this Tudor style, now let's be honest, of course, these are loose interpretations. That's one of the fun things about kind of taking things from the past. Just kind of taking things I want, not implementing all of it. I'm not trying to do a recreation. I'm just trying to make an homage and kind of use some inspiration from a particular time because the Tudors wouldn't have had Christmas trees. The Tudors actually on Christmas Eve itself, that still would have been a day of fasting on Christmas Eve. That Christmas Day was when you started the revelries, and we were having our revelries on Christmas Eve. So I wasn't being, you know, exactly historical, and I wasn't trying to be, but I was taking inspiration from this time period. And so we devised a loose Tudor menu together. I kind of drove it and then asked my friends, you know, we kind of created a Google Doc and we had a list of different foods that people could volunteer to bring. And of course, we want to make it easy. I like challenging myself and doing new things and different things because I like that. And I also wanted it to be familiar. So, you know, we had, you know, I'll tell you in a moment what we had, but you know, that was the idea. So we created a menu that was kind of loosely interpreted, loosely inspired by a Tudor menu. And I love entertaining. This was super fun to do this. We didn't dress up, and I'm always really mindful of that too. Some friends, you know, they don't want to, this wasn't a costume party, but we did kind of just lean toward making it more special. So I, you know, I got a dress that just felt really, and it was a beautiful dress from Modern Citizen, I think it was. It's a wonderful sustainable company if you haven't checked them out. It's a beautiful red dress. It wasn't Tudor style at all, but it had a bit of a higher neck and just felt really fancy and pretty, and it was red. And my friend Ellen, she actually did get a ruff. Like, so if you just look up Tudor ruff, that was that ruffly ruffled thing around the necks of both men and women in Tudor times. And so she got this kind of, it was a ruff, but it was like gold lamé, and it was really pretty, and it could be worn in different ways, and it could be worn with outfits, you know, because that's the, I don't want to ever buy an outfit that I wouldn't be able to wear again. I would never buy an outfit that I could only wear once. And so she bought a ruff, and that ruff made its way around the room, I will be honest. I think we have some photos making their way around the interwebs, but it was really fun to kind of come up with this. This year, we're actually having a Scandinavian, mostly Swedish-themed Christmas in honor of a couple of our friends whose heritage is Swedish. And I'll let you know about that menu another time. But it was fun to devise the Tudor-style menu, vegan style, of course, which would not have been a thing in Tudor times. Vegan would not have been a thing at all. A bona fide Tudor Christmas feast would have been, first of all, chock full of meat. Now, remember, again, we're talking about a time when the majority of people would not be eating meat throughout the year at all. So it was quite a treat, I hate to say, but it's true. It was quite a treat to have meat, not only given to you at a feast that you might attend at the you know, the estate's, you know, the lord of the estate, but you would be given probably a hen, probably meat as a gift from the estate owner. And if you went to a great, great feast, you'd still get the worst cuts of the meat, but it would still be a treat. Of course, we weren't doing that. Now, sadly, a really great Christmas carol from the Tudor period is all about the boar that would have been served at the king's Christmas feast, especially. But boar would have been served in like the grandest aristocratic houses. Henry VIII, you probably know, loved to hunt and eat boar. Sadly, because of the boar, poor boar. But also, I really love the tune of this. I love this carol, and it's just really annoying. I listen to a lot of medieval and Renaissance music and older carols, especially at Christmas time. You've probably heard this. You've probably come across it, even if you don't listen to Renaissance music. Here is a clip of the boar's head. It would be called the boar's head. And I'll read you the words in a moment. I'm just going to play a little portion of it. This is actually the chieftains singing this.
Boar's head and hand bear I bedecked with bays and rosemary, and I pray you my masters be merry, Podesta's in convivio. Couple up we never roll, rain and cloud is on me no. Couple up we never roll, rain and cloud is on me no. The boar's head, as I understand, is the rarest dish in all the land. When thus bedecked with a gay garland, let us serve here a county crow. Come and up, we get their home.
Anyway, you get the idea. So the boar's head and hand bear I, bedecked with bays and rosemary. I pray you, my masters, be merry. And then they sing it in Latin, basically. And then it's the boar's head, as I understand, is the rarest dish in all this land, which thus bedecked with a gay garland. It's a good tune, right? I really love that. Love the tune. Fortunately, it's about eating boar's head, but you get the idea. The carol was written in the 15th century to celebrate the consumption of the boar's head at Yuletide. Not at our feast. We weren't going for 100% accuracy, but we weren't even, I'm not going to even try to replicate. I'm not going to do a vegan version of boar's head. But there were a lot of things that they were keen on that we were able to still serve today. And I played with some of those and I used them as inspiration. So the Tudors loved all things in pastry crust. So lots of pies. They loved pies. And in Tudor times, they didn't really distinguish between sweet and savory dishes as much as we do. But my main dish was inspired by having both. So something like, for instance, I did kind of like a better than chicken pot pie with sweet potatoes and a lot of spices that were almost like Moroccan inspired and also included raisins. And so, that's the idea of a mince pie, right? So a mince pie, mince tart is, that's the idea. It's a lot of dried fruit. And a lot of it does reflect, especially in Tudor times, it would reflect the trade that was going on at the time with North Africa, with the Middle East. And so a lot of the spices came in to England from these places. And so you would find these spices, especially, of course, in the king's palace. You wouldn't find them in your average home. But that's why you have mince pies, which would be made with dried fruit. Now, suet, of course, as well, but we can use other fats for that. So that's what I did. I made our main dish in pie form, and I just built it up kind of by hand and made this gorgeous pastry crust. And I believe I have a recipe. Oh my gosh, I think I have a recipe for it on the website. If I don't, let me know that you're interested in it. I'll make sure you have what you need. But it was a direct descendant of pies from our Tudor ancestors. And so that's what I did. And then also using a lot of spices and dried fruit and sugar also would have been a big deal. That's where the spice cake comes in, the Christmas cake, especially a thing in the UK, is having a Christmas cake with a lot of spices. And again, the mints, that's all from the idea of the Tudors using lots of spices and sugar, because it really showed off your wealth to have these spices from foreign lands, the sugar from foreign lands. And so it was a real mark of your wealth. Bread and cheese would have been on the dining table for sure. So we had beautiful locally made, loaves of bread from bakeries around the area. And we did have cheeses. We had, I think I made some of my own from the vegan table, but I think we also had some of Miyoko's cheeses. Winter vegetables would have shown up for sure in stews. And we had winter vegetables. We had sweet potatoes. We had potatoes. We had potatoes also in my pie, but we also had sweet potatoes on the side. We had Brussels sprouts and other brassicas. And again, we weren't being 100% trying to be perfectly accurate, but you would definitely have found those in more affluent households. As far as the drinks, we had mulled wine, which is similar to a wassail. A wassail, spices would have been used in wines. They would have been added to wine. Wine would have been imported from France, no doubt. And the wine would have been spiced. So that's what your mulled wine, your glühwein, your wassail. Wassail would normally be ale that would have spices, but it could be made with cider, it could be made with wine, and then spices added to it. So we had spiced wine, and it was just wonderful. And then for dessert, now the dessert banquet during the Tudor era would have been quite lavish, and we did have a really fun spread. So I did make my Yule log, and you could call it a bûche de Noël, which was a French cake of a thin sponge that would be rolled up with buttercream inside and decorated with ganache and some decorations on the outside. as a Yule log, it's the same dish, but we're calling it a Yule log instead of a Bûche de Noël. And you can now get that recipe for my Yule log, which is a chocolate sponge. And it is, I have two different sponges I make in the class. So this is an on-demand class. You can watch the video of me teaching the class. It was a super fun class with lots of lovely people. And I give you the recipes, and the recipes are for a chocolate sponge. And in the class, I actually do two versions of the chocolate sponge, one of which has a very special ingredient. I fold in some aquafaba meringue, and I'm going to be really honest with you, I'm never making my cakes just again ever in the future without this, because it made the cake so amazing. And then we made buttercream frosting, and we made chocolate coconut ganache. And if you're interested also in the meringue, mushroom meringues, little meringues that are shaped like mushrooms, they're wonderful for decoration on the Yule log. That's another class that you can get. And that is the holiday, is it the holiday food gifts? It might be the joy of holiday baking. I think that's what it was. And that has the little mushroom meringue. So you can get both those classes, you get all those recipes, and you can make a Yule log with beautiful decorations. And it really is quite the centerpiece. You will impress your friends. You will impress your family. So gingerbread would have been another item on the dessert banquet. So gingerbread, or could be cookies, gingerbread cookies, could be bread itself. So anything that had ginger in it would be on the Tudor menu. Custard tart, and you can make a custard tart vegan, obviously. I've got custard in many of my different recipes. Marzipan, it would have been called March Pain then. Marzipan was a big deal in Tudor times, and so you can make a custard pie. You can make your custard pie with marzipan as well. A Christmas cake I already mentioned, like a spice cake. Candied fruit, so again, really showing off the sugar. So candied fruit is something you can get, some really nice candied fruit. Candied citrus would have been a way of showing off your wealth. That's really special. And then the 12th night cake. So a 12th night cake, and we're gonna touch on 12th night here. 12th night was the Epiphany, and this was a bigger feast day than Christmas. It was the last night of the 12 days of Christmas, and this was not a standard Christmas cake. It was it would have been a lavish, delicious, probably spice cake still, but it would have had either a dried bean or a pea inside the cake. And this is where you get the idea of a king's cake from. And you see that in a lot of different traditions, even now today. It comes from this idea of whoever gets the pea or whatever it is you hide in the cake would be, you know, the king for the day or what have you. There's lots of different ways this tradition is manifested, but that's the idea of the 12th night cake. And so you can make that as well for your feast. And so those are some of the traditional foods that we served on Christmas Eve. And there's some of the foods that would have been served during the 12 days of Christmas. Of course, mine are veganized, obviously. But I want to share something with you that I have just added to the website. By the time you hear this, it will be on the website. And I'm just really excited about it because it's really fun. And as you've probably figured out after listening to me for, well, any short amount of time, or if you've been listening to me for a long time, you know I love themes and I love kind of making things special. So I came up with a recipe bundle that's at joyfulvegan.com that is called the 12 Days of Christmas. And these are not random recipes for you to use for the 12 Days of Christmas. These are recipes inspired by the song, the 12 Days of Christmas, that Christmas song, on the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me and all that. So I was really inspired to come up with this menu, but I don't do things just for novelty purposes. So I still came up with the recipes for this bundle that will be conducive to a feast that you might be hosting, or if you want to serve each one of these dishes for breakfast, lunch, or dinner throughout the 12 days of Christmas, you can do that. Or they can be part of one feast, or they can be part of the day of Christmas, and you can serve some things for breakfast or some things for dinner. You could have it for the weekend. You could have it just before Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. The point is, I did decide on the recipes for this menu with the 12 days of Christmas as my inspiration, but there, it's not just about novelty. It really, these are recipes that you will definitely enjoy and will make a perfect addition to your Christmas feasts. So the song The 12 Days of Christmas is an English Christmas carol. It was first published without any music. There's evidence that it actually may have first been French, but it wasn't until 1909 that it was arranged by an English composer named Frederick Austin, and that's the tune we have today. On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me. Apparently, there were different variations. At one point, it was not my true love, but my mother. So there's a version where it's on the first day of Christmas, my mother gave to me. So you could sing whatever you want. And it has changed a little bit over the years. But for the most part, there are birds in almost every single day of the 12 days. And if you look online, because you can look online, and you know, I didn't come up with this idea of doing the 12 Days of Christmas recipe bundle or recipe, you know, ideas. Other people have come up with this, but there aren't a lot of vegan ones. And so what you have from a lot of places, they are actually cooking, you know, actually like French hens, they're making chicken, or they're making, you know, a meat version of swan instead of the seven swans of swimming. I'll tell you, in doing this recipe bundle, I now actually know the 12 days of Christmas for the song. I know the song way more than I did before. So if you're looking to actually get that under your skin and really know what the sixth day is and the seventh day is and what your true love will give to you on the eighth day, go get this recipe bundle and you will forever associate the recipe that I have in the bundle with the day, and you're always going to remember what the day is. So if you ever have trouble, you'll always remember. And that's actually what they think, the historians think, were the origins of this song, was that it was a memory game, right? So, and it was a 12th night memory game. And you can play this. You can play this on 12th night, where the leader would recite a verse and each of the players would repeat the verse. And then the leader would add another verse and so on until one of the players made a mistake and they would, I don't know, pay a penalty. They'd have to give a kiss to someone or a sweet or drop out of the game or whatever it was. It's kind of like the game we play. We play a car game. I don't know if you've ever played it. Like, I'm going on a picnic. And you use the alphabet. It's also a memory game. So I'm going on a picnic and I'm bringing apples. And then the next person goes and says, I'm going on a picnic and I'm bringing apples and bananas. And the next person goes and says, I'm going on a picnic and I'm bringing apples, bananas, and cats, right? So the idea is that you keep building, and that's what the 12 days of Christmas most likely is. The gifts in the song are mostly all birds. They're not all birds because, of course, you've got ladies dancing and lords leaping, but for the most part, they're birds. And because, as I said, some of the verses and words have changed over the years. There used to be bears a-roaring and bulls a-baiting. If you remember, bear baiting was very popular, a popular blood sport in Victorian times. We've talked about bear baiting before and bull baiting. And you can go to places in London where there were outdoor arenas where you could go and pay to watch bears being baited and bulls being baited. And so that was actually, they were like versus during the Victorian times, so that's no surprise. But for the most part, you've got the birds and the verses that we have that have lasted for a long time now, for a long time, for at least a century. Now, a couple things to note is calling birds, which is the fourth day, it wouldn't have been calling birds originally. The word collie meant black as coal, so collie birds were most likely have been blackbirds. And then five golden rings, you know, five gold, right? Or five gold rings, depends on where you are. I think Americans say five golden rings. Other places say five gold rings. They weren't pieces of jewelry. They were referring to like ring-necked birds, like pheasants. So five golden rings would have referred to five pheasants, right, with gold rings. But you also have the ladies leaping, etc. So today they're almost all birds. Some are hidden, like I said, and we're not including them as delicacies at all in our menu. You have instead, I'll give you a little hint. If you go to joyfulvegan.com, you can get this bundle and you can see everything that I have there. But instead of, you know, partridge in a pear tree, of course, we're not baking any partridges, but we are baking pears. Yeah. our five golden rings. We're doing a golden ring of monkey bread. Monkey bread is amazing. It's sticky, that really sticky round ring of a bread, which is all sticky little balls. Amazing. We're doing chocolate turtle doves. You know, like, you'll see. We're French toast instead of French hens. Why? Why do I have to, like, replicate hens? Why can't I just replicate the French part? So French toast, and you'll see more. Pink lady apples. For the, you'll see. You will see, and I have a nice combination of both sweet and savory. So these are not all sweet. And then we have, oh, I don't want to tell you all of them. You'll see them. Go to joyfulvegan.com, go to the on-demand classes and find the recipe bundle. Just type in Christmas and you will find the recipe bundle for the 12 days of Christmas. So I hope you enjoy them. And however you celebrate, whether you are taking time for contemplation beforehand or you're just jumping right into the revelries afterwards, I really hope you have a most wonderful holiday season. I hope you find peace and joy and camaraderie and connection and compassion during this holiday season and every single day. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.